Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
So she apparently had an artistic tendency, and the entire town seemed musical. We had an excellent band, and I had a couple of uncles who eventually ended up in a very famous Thomas Orchestra in Chicago. My mother, of course, played an organ we had. Pianos came in later even, and so the old organ had to be pumped to make it play. And I had one brother and one sister who sang professionally, so there was a kind of an artistic streak in the family. It was inevitable that I would become an artist. I didn't know why, I didn't ask why, and somehow or other my father, of course, wanted me to stay and assist him and become part of the furniture store. My older brother had disappointed him.
Networking son. Yeah.
And well, he never thought, we didn't care for any of that thing. We helped him, of course. We grew up, we were husky kids. There were three of us in the backfield of the high school football team when we got into high school. So we would handle furniture as though it were a toy and didn't mind it at all. All the heavy stuff he'd save until the Saturday delivery, or of course in football season, he always managed to save it so that we wouldn't miss a football game. But they were very lenient. Our parents were strict. As a matter of fact, we all smoked corn silk, but there was no inclination to what we generally call bad habits. The idea of using dope was not even heard of. I doubt if anyone in the entire community did it. Yes. Maybe a few of the doctors who knew what it was, but it was a good, solid little Yankee town. We had poplar trees and elm trees, everything that's traditional, the elm trees, of course, are gradually falling, but they're still there. But we lost the two in our yard. I think they were 100 years old and 3 feet in diameter, you know, terrific trees, one in our front yard.
Does your house still stand today?
The house still stands. When my father sold the furniture store, he added to it, thinking he could replenish his income with renting a few apartments. He made two little apartments in the house. Mm-hmm. And strangely enough, we went through a depression. People think that we're in a bad fix now, but golly, we've gone through two depressions in my lifetime that make us look like what do they call it? Valhalla or whatever it is. Yeah. The most delirious time that anyone could live in.
Yes.
But it was a pleasant town. Nobody ever talked about where. Matter of fact, we had a 2-acre garden. And us five kids went down there and planted corn and enough tomatoes, and everybody knew how to put up things in cans and glass jars in those days, and that was a big period. We'd grew enough tomatoes and corn so that it would carry us through the winter. And our stoves were wood stoves. I don't know if this is what you want.
I enjoy you rambling on.
We would bring in 18 cards of wood, they'd bring in a wood cutting machine, and they would cut the wood. We had two wood sheds, and one of them we'd fill solid with wood, and that was to burn in the cooks in the stoves. And of course, we each had our chore. There was cows to milk and horses to curry off and feed, and I happened to get the wood chopping job of getting enough small cordwood to keep the kitchen stove going, and another brother would bring in the cordwood, the big wood for the heating stove in the wintertime, and you really had a winter there.
Are your brothers and sisters still around?
What?
Do you still communicate with any of your brothers and sisters?
Oh, very closely, sure.
Are they all in the area here?
I have a brother living in Vista. That's 110 miles from here, my oldest brother. He has an avocado farm down there, so I get down as
still there. Farms. And
what?
Does he still farm?
He's not a farmer in any sense of the word, but he's what you'd call an aristocratic farmer. Him and his partner bought a chunk of 480 acres during the last war at $10 an acre. They now get $12,000 an acre for it, and so they don't have to worry about farming.
Just sell off a little bit of acreage.
So they sold off one block, I think, of 100 acres at $1,000 an acre. That's before they ever thought this present condition would exist. So they're holding on to it now. When they need a box of cigars, they sell an acre of ground.
Sounds like a good way to live.
Well, they were lucky. Of course, nobody would believe it would happen.
Yeah.
But it's happening everywhere in the country, and it's an unfortunate thing. And I don't believe that our government is smart enough to know what to do with it. They haven't done anything yet. And I noticed the dollar dropped today after the president's speech, because he didn't nail anything down, you know. Something can be done and has been done, and I suppose every country in the history of the world has run through the same situation. And it should be done. But you can't pick somebody out of a business in Georgia and make the most brilliant governor of the United States out of him in a couple of years. It can't be done. And we don't train as they do in England. Of course, England's, well, I'm not going to get into politics. That doesn't.
It sounds like you have been into politics.
No, I've
did lived. You, tell me, when did you vote for Nixon?
Who did he run against?
Let's see, Nixon ran against Kennedy, didn't he? Or no?
No, I voted for Kennedy. I probably voted for Nixon, but he didn't have his, well, he hasn't run for president since his miserable record. But that was a big political thing. I doubt if he was really, he was more dumb than many presidents.
And Kennedy, Nixon was against McGovern or McCarthy?
Yeah, McGovern. McGovern ran a very poor campaign, yeah. Very unfortunate.
Were you for McGovern at the time? Or
what?
Were you for McGovern?
No, McGovern didn't impress me and doesn't now. Nixon had a pretty good record, you know. He did a lot of good things. And I think he did stop that war over in Vietnam, which should have been stopped after the first week, because we had enough information about the French had been in there, and the situation had been described to us as absolutely untenable. There was no chance at all of our going in there. The old Yankee salesmanship, they didn't understand it at all, you know, because most of those people grow enough today to carry them through tomorrow, and that's all they have. They couldn't understand our philosophy of moving $1 billion worth of armament into their swamp land and trying to fight a fight with it that never should have been fought that way at all. And now they explain it by saying, well, we wanted to try out some of this machinery, and all they did was leave it there. And I guess it's junk metal now. They're grinding it up and making iron out of it or something.
Sounds like you stay on top of things somewhat. You
know, what?
It sounds like you read the paper every day. And
no, I don't take
things.
A paper. Well, I know a few people, and if anything really interests me, I try to learn a little about it. But actually, history repeats itself. About every 10 years, there's a similarity between the way things happen.
Let's get on to cartoons.
No, I don't think you can read this, and you can get one copy.
I enjoy hearing it from you, though.
you can get
it's
one.
It's difficult to turn it off because I find it interesting. Yeah, tell me, you went to
I went to Chicago
animation
Institute
school because this man gave you a loan. right?
$1,000, yes. Well, that carried me through a year of school in those days, and I had a sister who was studying music in Chicago, so I found a room in the same building that she lived in, South Chicago, right near the University of Chicago. And I went to the Art Institute, and I think I paid 3 months' tuition. And as soon as I got acquainted with the other students, I found that none of them paid tuition. There was, of course, the studio, or the Chicago Art Institute was financed probably by millionaires in Chicago, and I found that every student in there, almost, they were all in the same boat, and none of them had any money.
Yes.
and everyone had a job. I had at least two jobs almost immediately. As soon as you got acquainted with someone, I met Smitty, and he said, "Listen, I'm in the cafeteria over here. Why don't you come over and work an hour at lunchtime? You get two meals, your lunch and your dinner." And that was
sure.
That was about all we got out of it. And the next thing, Fitzpatrick, who became a very, very famous, for many years, internationally famous cartoonist on the St. Louis Post-Gazette, or one of those papers, he was in charge. He picked up the idea of supplying supernumeraries for theater groups where they needed a lot of soldiers, particularly in opera. And so immediately you'd get a dollar a night for that. And so we all had two or three little jobs of that kind. And that would usually pay our rent and give us a couple of meals a day. And finally I had a brother and another friend of mine who came to the University of Chicago, and we got a room together. However, I met an old artist, a commercial artist, who lived with his mother in the building where I originally moved, and he used to get me to come in and work for him. That was about the second year. And he taught me lettering. And even before that, I had already, a kid in my hometown.
Did they call it calligraphy in those days?
No, they didn't call it calligraphy. It was
just lettering.
But he was a genius. His academic figure training had not reached his talent as a letter artist, but he is a great guy, and he taught me a great deal. He knew all about engraving and reproduction and how to do a thing and how not to do it to get it reproduced. And within the next year or so, a kid in my hometown wrote a song, and somebody wrote the music, and he wanted to publish it, so I made the cover for it. And starting with that, I went into the music publishing houses. In those days, there were many of them, because people bought popular songs, took them home and played the piano and sang them. That business is gone. Radio mm-hmm. killed that. But I found that these people paid $10 a piece. Well, I was going in and working part-time with this letter artist for about $3 a week, and I found I could go home and make a song cover and get $10 for it. So it wasn't very long before I still worked with him. And I kind of dropped out of art school because the banker didn't want to loan me any more money, and that was gone. And I was making a living for myself, and actually beginning to save a little money. And another brother of mine came to Chicago, and with a friend of his that had played football with us in high school, we rented a studio, and I was an artist by that time. You know, I really didn't know the first out of the alphabet from A to Z. I knew about up to C maybe. But there were a lot of really good artists in this tree studio building. And that was an education, because I knew professionally, a couple of them taught in the Art Institute. I got to know these people permanently.
Yes.
I found out later that when I got to thinking about it, And I think it is probably the reason that most students go to Yale or Harvard or Princeton is to meet people rather than get an education. And I met a fellow who happened at one time in this little period that kept fluctuating. I met a fellow named Gregory LaCava, who was going to our institute, and we happened to have a room in the same house. And I suppose the reason I changed rooms was that I'd go home for 3 months in the summer and probably work in my father's furniture store or something. Mm-hmm. Finally, I reached a point where I could stay all the time. And anyway, Gregory LaCava was later to become an Academy Award type winner of live action director here in Hollywood. Maybe you've heard of his name. He directed a play, My Man Godfrey, which often appears on TV even today, and Primrose Path, and he was a man who at that time, which goes back, I think he died in the 60s sometime, he was getting $250,000 for directing the picture, which was a pile of money at the time he was directing in the early days of the Academy Award. But he left for New York. I stayed in Chicago, and finally we corresponded. And finally, I decided there were more music publishers in New York than there were in Chicago, and I went out and lived with him for a few months. And he was, at that time, animated cartoons had come in. This had to be about, I think they came during the First World War. And this probably was 1918, somewhere along in there. And he said, why don't you get into this animation thing? Where I was working, making 4 or 5 song covers a week and earning $50 or $60 a week. I found out that they were paying him $300 a week to do animated cartoons. That would be about like $1,500 a week today. And so he kept hammering away at me. He knew that I had made funny drawings. I mean, I used to draw cartoons. So he finally persuaded me to give up the song cover thing for a couple of weeks and try animation. You couldn't get artists. Nobody knew how to animate. Neither did I, of course. But with his tutelage, I went into the old William Randolph. Yeah, you should get that copy. I wrote one little story about William Randolph Hearst and about LaCava and the artists that were there. Yeah, you could send for a copy of that if you're interested.
At least I have the where to send to. Yeah, I'll buy one of these off you.
Yeah, you can know where to send. Yes, the address is in there, and in fact,
get a back issue.
He might give you a special price if he has any back issues. And fact, I'll tell him too.
Thank you.
He was out here only a couple of weeks ago. He spent a whole week here interviewing people at Disney's and people at other studios. Judd Hurd, I'm talking about, who edits the magazine. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I tried animating. He paid me $40 a week. I mean, this is the William Randolph Hearst studio, and he was directing, he was in charge of the studio. And some of the most famous animators in the world were there. They were right in the place. And I decided definitely at the end of 2 weeks, I could not make these damn things move. There was no way in the world. I don't know if it would bore you to describe what I did. LaCava made the first sequence of drawings. They had what they called a panorama.
Yeah, and you were the in-betweener?
There were no in-betweeners. You just sat down and animated. But I didn't know anything about how to panorama a thing. I didn't know how to do anything. But he made one sequence of a horse running. I think it was 8 drawings. And Happy Hooligan, this is in a horse race, and this old spavum beast that he was riding was just about ready to collapse. To keep him alive, he had a syringe, which presumably was filled with cocaine. He kept pouring his syringe into the horse to keep him on his feet. And I couldn't make head or tail out of the thing, you know. And finally, I realized that these things were really in the same. Do you know how the panorama moves? Have you ever gone into a cartoon studio and seen? What you do is keep the animal in one position and the background moves behind it, and gradually you feel that the animal is moving. I wasn't hip to that. In fact, they were not at that time. But then I measured the distance between each drawing and I found it was about a quarter of an inch. So I put the doggone things in a punch board and punched holes all the way across it. Then I traced one drawing, and then the next one I moved one punch hole ahead and the next one another punch hole. That way I got the horse and Hooligan across the paper and I was ready to quit. It was the roughest job I'd ever done. Like Hava said, "You're great, that's great." And he gave me another scene, and I think he said, "I'll raise you to $75 a week," which was about as much or more than I got out of song covers. So I'll try this another couple of weeks. And then I got a scene that I could understand. It was, I'd been fishing, I grew up fishing. Happy Hooligan wanted to steal a suit of clothes, so he was apparently living in a hotel or something. So he put a big hook on the end of a fishing line and threw it through the transom of a room and hooked a suit of clothes, which presumably was hanging on a hook inside the door, and pulled it out. And I got intrigued with this because I had pulled in many a fish. So I had the pole tug and I tried to reel it in. I finally pulled it out and brought this suit of clothes through the transom. And golly, I had it made. That was animating. Mm-hmm. And at that time, strangely enough, Lacava.
That was about 1920 or something like that.
I call it 1923 because the story, I couldn't identify it except with other things that happened at that time. And this may not be what you want to talk about.
That's all right. This is tells me where you came from.
Lacava had decided, and seen how rich William Randolph Hearst was, and he knew how hard it was to get animators, and he was a very ambitious young Italian kid from Syracuse, New York, and he decided that it wouldn't hurt Hearst at all to pay him $600 a week instead of $300 a week. I accidentally found out how much he earned, much to my surprise, because that was an amazing amount of money for a kid. He was in his 20s, an amazing amount for him to be earning at that time. And I had lived with him, as a matter of fact, for, I don't know, a month or two or something like that when I first came out. And he had... he'd accidentally left his check. And I guess he wasn't a drinking man, but apparently he'd been out and spent a night with some of the animators. And he was oversleeping one morning, and I got up and dressed, and the check was lying on the dresser, and I saw that it was free. He told me he was getting $150 a week, which didn't make any difference, really. $150 was a fortune in those days. Anyway, Hearst fired him. He paid him off his entire contract, which was $65,000.
Wow.
So young Lacava came out to Hollywood and started writing titles for the Max Centet comedies. And it wasn't a year before he was directing little short live-action pictures. Mm-hmm. Was the, not Tom Mix. Was there an actor in those early days with the name of Mix or something?
Tom Mix?
Not Tom. He was a cowboy, wasn't he? Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Yeah. But he, one of these good-looking young cowboy-style actors, the cop made a feature picture every month, and he paid him $1,000 a month. When I, later on, when Hollywood began to blossom with animators and animation, which was 1932, I came out here, of course, and I worked for Iwerks, and of course I saw Gregory, and I had a dinner at his house, and he was then in the process of asking for a raise. $1,000 a week didn't satisfy him. So he finally really got up into the big money, probably as well paid as any of the big directors at the time. And probably if I had been smart and been a money-minded, I would have got in with him as an assistant director and then been a lot. But I loved drawing, and I loved drawing, and by that time I loved animating, and I had built a little name for myself, and so I got in with Iwerks, and eventually from Iwerks to Disney's, and got into the Snow White.
Tell me about, you had already known who Disney was at that time. Was that a big thrill? How did it come to be that you moved to Disney? How did that all happen?
I was working in Flashers. That was in 32. In the meantime, I had saved enough money, actually. I finally got my salary up working for Hearst immediately. Oh yes, when LaCava left, he said, go in and dicker with him. He said, don't take less than $100 a week. So I jumped from 40 to 75 to 100, all in 2 or 3 months. So I had managed to save money on that. You could really, the average fairly well-paid person in those days was getting $30, $35 a week. So in the meantime, I had married a little girl from my hometown, and we saved enough money, and I went over and studied in Vienna for 3 years. I wanted to be an illustrator. That was, I had met Dean Cornwell. I don't know, you probably are not familiar with illustration at its peak. There were some really great painters. Of course, many of their things now are being gobbled up by the big art galleries because they were fine art.
Yes, yes.
Some of them, I maintain, were better than many things that were painted by Rubens and Rembrandt and those fellows. And the galleries are beginning to realize that. And that's, I'd known Dean Cornwell very well. As a matter of fact, he came into this old artist, he may have been 40 years old, I call him an old artist. He and Dean Cornwell came up from Louisville, Kentucky, and worked in the same studio. And while I was working for about $3 a week, Cornwell was getting 25, but he could do the whole thing. Developed into one of the real, as a matter of fact, in our public library downtown here, you can see a Dean. Have you ever been in the library downtown?
The one downtown Los Angeles?
Yeah.
Yes.
Have you noticed the mural decoration?
Mm-hmm.
That was done by Dean Cornwell. $65,000 job, which was a fortune at that time.
Yes, yes.
He was the most noted, he became from this little Art Morris studio that he worked and was doing things for Imitation Maple Syrup and for cigar boxes and things. Mm-hmm. He became the foremost mural decorator in the United States. And he went through illustration to get up there. He became one of the foremost painters in America. But he went awfully rapidly. God, he was a genius, which I never was. Anyway,
instead of jumping to Disney, can we go to Fleischer?
At Fleischer's, yeah. I happened to get in and...
It started in New York, right?
And, that's the story I tell here of how I happened to create the Betty Boo. So I won't bother telling you about that. It just, briefly, it was, Dave came in one day with a song, a popular song that Helen Kane was singing, and put it in my desk and said, give a little, they had this little Bimbo, is that the name of their dog?
Mm-hmm. And, something like that, yeah.
And so they said they were making what they called song cartoons. And he said, design a little girl. Well, the animators designed all the characters at that time, all of those early characters and the Fleischers. He never had a designer work there. All of the characters in the pictures were designed by the animators. So he gave me this little girl to design, and I turned out the Betty Boop.
And can I ask you this first? How did you come to working at Fleischer? Who referred you?
Oh, well, when I first returned from Europe, when I got back from Vienna, and I landed in New York with $5 in my pocket, and I was just able to, my brother was still living, and he managed to have a place where we could, my wife was with me, and unfortunately she had contracted tuberculosis over there, and they had no cure for it at that time. That was probably the most tragic period of my life. She only lived for about a year after that, but we got into New York, and my brother happened to find rooms that we could take where he lived, just off of Broadway, I think on Riverside Drive. And I just walked down one night down Broadway and 42nd, which was New York to me, you know, to look at the signs and the lights and get the feel of the city. I'd been away 3 years. Yeah. It seemed strange to hear people speaking English. The whole place was unusual.
I've been to Europe, so I know. You probably appreciated it so
much more. Oh, golly, it was mysterious. And of course, our studio had once been right at the entrance, right where 7th Avenue crosses Broadway, right at the intersection, then it opens up at Times Square. And I was strolling down on the 7th Avenue side of Broadway, and somebody said, "Hey, Grim Natwick, when did you get into town?" It was Bill Nolan. And I mentioned Bill, not in this story, in the Fleischer, or in the Hearst story, which is in one of the issues. And Bill had just left the studio. It was probably 7 at night, and very often they'd work overtime, and one of the gals from the inking department was with him, and we didn't drink, none of us, even then, you know. He said, "We're going to remember about Colvin, about Pinto. I don't know if I'll ever do it. When I get a hunch, I jot down what I think of, and maybe a month later I think of something else." Mm-hmm. But I don't have a very good...
Let me tell you about what I know about Vance and Pinto. I know that Vance was Bozo the Clown.
Yeah.
You see? And when I went to interview Vance at his home, he said, "Well, you know who my father is, don't you?" And he said, "Who?" And he said, "Pinto Colvin." And I said, and then it all came to me, you know. I said, "Wow, that's great, you know." And he told me that Pinto did Bozo also. Did you know that?
I saw him do it, and that's what interests me, because I was trying to write down something about that, and I couldn't remember the name, so I wrote down Bosco, which is all right.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, yeah.
Nobody else knows it happened, Christ, 20 years ago or so. Uh-huh.
I remember Bosco.
I don't know if there was a Bosco?
Yes. Uh-huh. There was a character, Bosco, that Friz Freleng did for a while. That's all I know because I've interviewed.
Well, I didn't know there ever was. I was trying to think. I wrote Bobo and Bimbo and Bosco.
There was a Bosco.
And that was just, that sounded the best, so I left it. But anyway, yeah, if you have his address, I'd like to call him up.
And sure, he's a real nice
guy. Up a few. Well, does he do this thing now? What does he do it for? On TV or something?
Well, see, while Pinto was at Disney, it was Capitol Records that needed a Bozo the Clown record. You see, there was a character already established, Bozo. But the, you know, the Bozo as you saw him as the clown, it was drawn on a an album cover.
Well, I saw Pinto actually performing the thing.
Yes, yes, yes. But he originally started it for Capitol Records, and it became so popular that they said, let's make a TV show of it. And so he dressed up just like the album cover, and that's how you saw him perform. Yeah. He did that for about 6 years.
What was what were the records? What was on the records?
Songs that he would sing, and Alan Livingston, you know, wrote the songs and produced the records. And I talked with him also. I have all those old records.
Yeah.
If you would like to have some, do you have anything like tape or record? I mean, you have a tape machine at all?
I have a tape machine. Yeah.
A cassette.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. Because you're doing me this favor here, I'll make up a tape that I have Vance talking about his father, and I have a lot of recordings of Vance I'll throw in with it, okay? So you'll have a tape of Pinto Colvig.
Oh, that'd be interesting.
I have also Dawes Butler talking about Pinto Colvig.
Oh, yeah?
In fact, I have...
Where do you get hook on all these names?
How do I trace them down? That's part of it. Let me show you my scrapbook so you can see kind of who I am, and I can tell you about myself because I know a little bit about you. I'm not sure you. I don't need to
teach his young animators what they couldn't get over there. I spent 8 months there and got very well acquainted. And as a matter of fact, the French family owned this apartment building. And Mrs. French and her daughter came over there. Apparently Dick had met her and they finally married. Now this grandson, I guess he was here today, now Dick came over here and he's opened his studio in Hollywood too. He comes from Canada originally, but through Dick I met this family and she was at the dinner. And, in fact, one of her sons and his wife were there too. But I don't know what the hell we're talking about.
We're talking about the Renaissance Fair is where
she has a son who has the front apartment here.
Oh.
And he spent 2 years at the Renaissance. He went, where do they have it? Up in Frisco?
They have one out there in Frisco.
And one down here. Yes, and he may even have, were you in the thing? Did you perform?
I've been in the Renaissance Fair for 13 years.
Oh, he may have photographs of it.
Oh, yeah. Okay, here we're looking at that December thing that was. Oh, and you have them
numbered. I have them numbered here.
I see.
Yes.
You have them numbered.
Which was the only way I could think to go out to June and would write them down. I'd just have a list of numbers, then put the name beside them. Then I wouldn't have to scribble all over this. But,
well, looking at the front of it, starting at the top left-hand corner, this guy is who? You know? Offhand?
No.
Here's Mel Blanc.
Yeah.
This gal here in the left-hand corner, do you know her?
No.
This is...
I know that's Hannah.
Bill Hannah.
Yeah.
Here's Bill Scott, and I don't know who this guy is. Here's Joe Barbera, June Foray, of course. I don't know who this guy is.
That's Lever, Steve Lever.
Is he an artist or something?
He was with Film X, and he once took charge of the USIFA office.
I see.
They had a donation from somebody that paid his salary, kept him there last year, but then the fund went out and he left with it.
Seems so. Like a young guy. Here's Tom
He's
Hatton.
Quite young.
Tom Hatton, of course. And then who's this guy now?
Well, that is the space writer. What the hell is his name? Very famous author. Does motion picture scripts. Quite important. What the hell is his name? You know who he is. But,
How about this guy right here?
Oh, that's Loki, Hicks Loki. He's an animator. He's been in business. He's in Hanna-Barbera now.
I see.
This is Leland, and of course, this is me.
And how about this gentleman here?
What page are you on?
Let's see.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
You switched over. I see. I have the page this way. I had to Xerox them one at a time. That, I don't have that guy here. No, I should know him. He looks important, doesn't he?
Inside the top, yeah. And this gentleman here with the glasses.
That's Art Babbitt.
That's Art Babbitt.
Yeah.
I didn't see him.
Well, this is, what's
Ed
his name?
Dawes. Yeah, Bill Hurt. This is this guy again. How about this gentleman here? The one.
I don't know who he is either. This is, I know this gal, she was taking pictures around the room. She's in animation. She's worked in Hanna-Barbera. Funny little name.
How about this guy?
Yeah, I know him too. He works with I know their names. I just can't grab them. Jumping around this way.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, rather than me asking you, tell me who you might recognize here.
Oh, he's the writer for the Los Angeles Theater, Charles Champlin.
Oh, yes.
I don't know who he is. Of course, that is Bezesta's son. Because that's me. Wait, which is Bezesta's son? Nick Bezesta, one of these, either that guy or this guy, I think this guy. But I don't know these other guys. They were accepting these awards for somebody else, usually.
I see. Now, what was this award you were holding? Craig,
I was holding the Raggedy Ann Award.
And you accepted it for us?
I accepted it for the people who financed it. I still have it. They never collected it.
Really?
They were going to take, like Steve Leva and me out to a big dinner, you know, and I was going to deliver the award to them. Well, I don't have those pages, but... that's Golden, Les Golden. He's very active in the business. As a matter of fact,
he's like an actor. Yeah, I've seen him before.
Have you seen him?
Yeah, I've seen the face before. He's an actor.
I didn't know that. I don't know him. I don't know who these people are.
Or he looks like an actor. Yeah, of course,
this
June's helper.
And Potler, I guess. Ann Potler. I should know her too. I don't know them. That's
Bill Hurt.
No, there are a lot of these people I didn't know, and apparently they're all pretty important people, or they wouldn't have printed them in here. So, I know. I forget what happened, and a whole flock of birds flew out toward the audience, and all these kids ducked, you know. My daughter said, they didn't hit me.
Yeah. And it was just animation.
It was absolutely real, sure. I've heard a lot of stories about the reality of these characters.
My idea was to almost be able to walk into a television set, into the cartoon itself, and say, wait a minute, stop this cartoon. Who's doing your voice, and who drew you, and who thought up this whole idea anyhow, and who's making all that music? You see, and then be able to ask these people these questions. So here I am coming to you, and can I start off, where are you from, Grim? And can I ask you, and if you don't want to tell me, it's fine, where are you from, and when were you born?
I've avoided that because I've been asked it 10,000 times, and I usually say, well, you can call me a veteran or one of the,
but that's enough.
The old guys in the business.
That's fine.
Everybody who knows when Betty Boop started can add whatever they want to, and I don't give a damn. But I've been to places where it seemed that the only interest they had was how old I was, and then they left. They thought, okay, that's
the
all.
The reason why I asked this was because I later want to ask you, what kind of childhood did you have? Was it a happy childhood?
Well,
because I always feel this.
I have tried,
life.
You know, every once in a while I think I should write something about this. I grew up in a little lumber town right in the center of Wisconsin. And I could
say, can I turn off that radio? Because I think my
right.
Microphone.
I should have thought of that, yeah.
There, that's better.
Turn it off. Did you turn it off? Turn it all the way off. Because usually I get music in the background and kind of company, so I just leave it on and forget about it. Yeah, it was a little lumber camp, a lumber town. Mm-hmm. There were three or four small mills, every creek almost around there that had any water flowing through it, had a little lumber mill because I could look out of the backyard, our backyard, of course, which was probably half an acre or something like that, and directly across a little lane that separated us from the next fence, there was a solid forest of white pine. And
sounds beautiful.
Even occasionally a deer would poke his head out of the trees over there, you know, and it was wild. Actually, we had a swamp in our backyard. In the winter it froze and we could skate on it. In the summer it would grow water lilies and cowslips. You know what a cowslip is? It grows in water. It's a beautiful anemone sort of a yellow flower, but it comes up wild all over the swamps. It doesn't have lilies. It grows more like an anemone that you'd plant in your garden. I believe it would belong to that family. And I even had my little private violet and Johnny Jump Up patch under a pine. There were something like 22 pine trees in our backyard at that time. Of course, eventually they were sold out and two houses were built there.
Yes,
but.
Yes.
And directly across the dirt road in front of our house was the Wisconsin River, which in some cases is a quarter or a half mile wide. It's a tremendous stream. But there was nothing on it except the town bridge, which occasionally the ice floes in the springtime would carry out the bridge till finally they began to build mills on it.
And what state was this now?
This was in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
And now the town is now called Wisconsin Rapids, but it went through two or three. Our side of the town was called Centralia. The other side of the town was called Grand Rapids because there was a drop in the river about 35 feet there. The Indians called it Attawagum, which means Big Rapids.
Sounds
beautiful. It dropped about 35 feet. It was a tremendous waterfall. And of course, eventually, it was already being used. There was a mill on each side that just used a little of this waterfall.
Which was kind of picturesque.
And the town was very picturesque. And I've always regretted because the riverbank was lined with things like barber shops and blacksmith shops and shoe shops and things like that. And it is really quite a river. It supports terrific industry now.
And your parents at that time, what were they doing?
My father grew up in the lumber camp. My grandfather had come over from Norway.
Norway.
And him and his Norwegian wife, and that was Grandma's farm to us. It was 13 miles away, and on big holidays, we'd get a lot of buggies from the livery stable and the whole family drive on. I had, gosh, there were 8 of us kids, you know. I had 5 brothers and 2 sisters.
Mm. Wow.
And even though my father, who knew lumber, eventually he came into the town and he became a postmaster in this little town, and then he opened a furniture store. And as far as I could find out, the more money he borrowed to build that furniture store, he hadn't paid back to the bank at the time he died. It was just that kind of a town. And Isaac Witter, who was the richest man in town, owned the bank. And even when my time came to go to art school, he loaned me $1,000. And that took me through art school. But of course, art students, I found out half of the art students in Chicago when I went there came by hitching a ride on a freight train or something, and we all had jobs in restaurants and as supernumeraries in the theater and every little pickup job. That some of the smart ones would get a job in charge of the kids that would work in, oh, what do they call it, cafeterias. There were a lot of cafeterias in those days in the center of Chicago. So we got a couple of meals for work in noon hour in the cafeteria. This is jumping from my youth. In my youth, it was very happy. Everybody
had a lot of brothers and sisters to play with in the woods.
Well, 3 roads came together. They converged right in front of our house. That made a great big triangle there. They all came from different directions. That was our baseball field. And with 5 brothers, Christ, you know, there are always 3 or 4 of us very close to the same age. So that is the whole neighborhood used it for a baseball field. And when we got a little older, then we used Carey's pasture, which is a big, probably a 40-acre thing, part forest and part grassland. Everybody owned their own cow. If it was a big family, they had 2 cows. We had 2 cows and a horse or 2. And so us kids would get $15, I guess 15 cents a week,
yeah,
to drive a cow to pasture. And that was our spending money, and just about the limit of it. So the whole town, and the cows would always go down on the sloping banks of the river, wade in and get a drink and saunter on. You couldn't hurry a cow to pasture. It was about an hour's work to get her there and an hour to get her back at night. Sometimes getting them back in the lush part of summer, the cows would like to go into the woods where they could brush flies off of themselves.
Yeah.
By going in the hazelnut brush, you know, the low bushes that, yes, they could brush against. Sometimes you'd have to go way back into the woods to get the darned animals and bring them back. But that was, the whole thing was a placid little pure river. You could drink water right out of the river. It is absolutely
pure.
Sounds
like a whole different kind of life than when I grew up. Well, I'm 26.
Yeah, well,
I grew up with TV. And I, you know, neighbors on each side of me. And
I would suspect you wouldn't find another river that size. It's a 400 mile long river, which means it is quite a stream. And fishing was that. You could sit on a rock right in front of our house and catch smallmouth bass and walleye pike, which are the finest eating fine game fish.
Yeah, my brother would love to hear that story. He's a fisherman, yeah.
And we had spring water creeks. Of course, Wisconsin had originally been glacial lands. The glaciers had grown there. They say, according to the people who study those things, eventually the mountains were possibly 4,000 feet high there. But they were all ground down until the tallest peek in Wisconsin. Of course, it's about 2,000 feet above sea level. So it's a cool climate, and they have what they call high marshes. And there have been woods in there for 10,000. I think the glaciers went over there 10,000 years ago, which is quite recent.
Yeah.
And it ground down through this sandstone, and the Dells of Wisconsin were a great show place. Some of these, the glacier had gone through this sandstone and left stones standing maybe 8 or 100 or 120 feet tall, of course. Unfortunately, that beautiful part of the river has been partially dammed up because there is a wonderful channel 100 feet deep. So they've used that now for electrical power. But
It sounds like you've had a chance to go back and see it.
Oh, I went back every summer, sure. The Dells is still there. Uh-huh. People still come to see the Dells, but not the Dells that I saw as a kid. We would take
A waterfall still there?
Oh, no, but they put a 35-foot dam in our town, and that's nothing but water power, but it created a beautiful lake that's about 18 or 20 miles long. And, of course, the water has been polluted, but fortunately the government's getting stricter and stricter, and the game fish are beginning to come back into that water. But the Wisconsin travels about perhaps 200 miles south of us and flows into the Mississippi. But it was a placid, it was like an old Curry and Ives picture of a small town.
You painted a picture like that, it sounds like that.
Yeah, it was beautiful, and when the ice took about 2 weeks at a certain, usually in March or April, the ice froze 3 feet thick on the river. As a matter of fact, before refrigeration, the ice houses simply went out with big saws and team of horses and sawed these blocks of pure ice out of pure water, and that's what we used, and we'd chip it off and drink it. There was no impurity into the water at all. So you'd get blocks of ice, and they'd saw them up in comfortable pieces. Everybody had an ice box. You didn't freeze anything in those days, and even the butcher shops kept things only a certain limited number of times. And the Scandinavian and the German and the French and the British moved in there. There was a conglomeration. The British.
So you were in the Scandinavian community?
Well, the whole community was that mixture. Of course, I have learned since I grew up that usually those little countries across the 35-foot channel, all the kids in school, the Scandinavian kids, have about 7 or 8 years of English, so even the Scandinavians that moved in there probably spoke fairly good English. And
when did you begin to get into drawing things, and
well,
how did all that start?
I started drawing certainly at age 7, and I remember the first drawing that I did. I had my oldest brother was mechanical minded, but he apparently could draw pretty well, and particularly he drew a very good picture of a steamboat, which intrigued me, and he colored it, and I thought that's pretty good, so I copied it, and I was pretty happy with the copy. I ran downstairs to show it to somebody, and he said, "What the hell are you doing with my picture?" He beat the hell so I must have drawn pretty well from the beginning. I distinctly remember drawing, copying about that time. Oh, the Ancient Mariner. Did you ever see one of those old copies illustrated with beautiful pen line?
It looks like it's a really tiny line. Like
yes, it looks
almost
like steel engraved. And I copied those, and I loved the way the drawing was clear and. And then
I see a lot of those on postcards from Europe, those kind of drawings.
Very probably. And we had one of those books in our house, and the library of our house is marvelous. My mother had been a school teacher, and in those days, as now, you can buy encyclopedias or groups of literature by paying $2 a month, yes, or yes, $10 a month, or $20 a month today, or something
like that.
And we had a lot of these books, and they were really an education. One marvelous Shakespearean book, which I think I finally managed to get a hold of. I think I have that stored somewhere.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.